From KMUW Wichita,
from Toronto, Ontario,
and from Armenia, Spain,
this is You're Saying It Wrong. Let's talk words. Let's talk rhetoric as we explore some common rhetorical devices and how we might use them more often than we think. I'm Fletcher Powell, host and producer at KMUW in Wichita, Kansas, and joining me, as they do every week, the authors of 43 zillion books on the English language, Kathy Petras and Ross Petras. Kathy Petras, hello. You're in your home there in Armenia, Spain. How's it going, Kathy? I do think that we have a little something to talk about before we really get going at all today, though.
Are you talking about the error I made?
No, the joke you made, Kathy, the joke you made.
That was silly, silly me. And it's interesting, someone realized that I was making a tongue-in-cheek remark. we're speaking about the other week when we were talking about the pronunciation of certain names. And I commented that Wagner College in New York, I think it's in Staten Island, isn't it? I don't know. Was named after Richard Wagner, but they called it Wagner, and it was not named after Richard Wagner, nor was it named after Richard Wagner, for that matter. I was being clever. Let's just say that, huh? What do you think?
Yeah, sure.
That sounds like a very good sister excuse for being wrong.
Yeah. I used to work with Mom, Ross. What can I say? I was kidding, Ma. I was kidding.
No, but we did make a mistake. It's actually named after, coined by John G. Wagner in memory of his son. And I presume he pronounced his name Wagner, not Wagner.
Although I want to say, though, I got a message from an old high school friend of mine who back then was named Cynthia Wagner, and she said that the family name had been Wagner, and they anglicized it from the Dutch.
Here we go with the problems of pronunciation. It varies, and it's always hard to get it right. But one thing you were right about, Kathy, it is in Staten Island. So that's good.
See, I was not joking about that. That was very serious.
Oh. Not near Staten Island or in Staten Island, but I guess nearer than I am. Ross Petras, hello in Toronto. How are you?
Hello, Fletcher, and hello, Kathy. I'm doing great. How are you two?
Yeah, as I mentioned last week or the week before, it's allergy season here in Wichita, and it is just wreaking havoc on me. So again, if I sound a little bit ridiculous, that's partly because of the allergies and partly just because that's who I am.
Yeah, we're dying here with allergy in Spain, too, which is possibly one of the reasons I made that incredibly funny joke about college.
Thank you to Albert, who pointed that out to us, and anyone else who may have noticed Kathy's hilarious joke.
I will probably continue to make some every now and then.
I guess I say this a lot, but today I'm super excited because we are going to talk about some things that we do with the English language that we don't necessarily even realize that we're doing. And the way you guys described it was that we are all rhetoricians. Is that what you said?
Yes.
Well, Ross and I both like to pattern ourselves after Cicero. So.
Cicero. Oh, nice. Cicero.
Well, I think we're Greek, Kathy. I think it's more like Demosthenes, Kathy. It's Demosthenes.
Although Demosthenes had those pebbles in his mouth. Ross, I don't want to put rocks in my mouth. We want to start, though, actually. We're going to backtrack a little bit. You know, the other week before Wagner week, we talked about Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. And we were saying, like, did this come from Shakespeare or not? Was he the originator or the popularizer? And speaking of Demosthenes, as Ross said, I should Demosthenes, I'm trying to sell that rocks in my mouth. We were thinking of the phrase, it's Greek to me.
Oh,
it
yeah.
was Greek to me, which, as we know, was spoken in Julius Caesar by Casca. Is that Shakespeare? Was that originated by Shakespeare? It was Greek to me, Fletcher?
Oh, wow. I guess I wouldn't have thought it was, but that sure seems like a Shakespeare type little joke or something, doesn't it?
Well, actually, though, we found that it goes way, way earlier than that. And it actually originally was Latin, and it was originally written on manuscripts as Graecum est non legitur, which means this is Greek, it can't be read. And the idea was that as classical civilization ended, the empire split into the Greek side, which was in Byzantium, which was in, you know, modern day Turkey and Greece, and the western side. And the western side, they basically spoke Latin. And so they would get old manuscripts and making copies, and they would see Greek, and they would have no idea what it meant or said. So they would write in as they're recopying, because they didn't have printing presses, they would recopy. And as they're writing in, they'd see this weird gibberish in this weird language and write, "Graecum est non ligatur." It's Greek to me, I can't read it, can't be read. So that's where it came from. Because of that, though, it tempted us to start looking at other Greek to me words. And rhetoric was developed by the ancient, well, in the West, it was developed by the ancient Greeks. And they had all sorts of technical terms. And when I was learning ancient Greek, they would have lists of these technical terms, and I was ready to scream. Because they're all complicated, long words that I had no idea what they meant, and I didn't care at all. But interestingly enough, we use the techniques as described by the ancient Greeks, and then from there the Latins, and then from there rhetoricians in modern times. We use these techniques, but we don't even know we're using them. Mm. So in effect, we all are Cicero or Demosthenes.
Cicero.
Well, Cicero would be the correct Latin pronunciation that Kathy quickly pointed out.
I don't speak ancient Greek, okay? Neither did Wagner, as I recall.
So what we're going to do, Fletcher, is we're going to give you, like, basically usages, and we're going to see if you can guess the Greek or technical rhetorician word for it.
Oh, God.
See what's going on.
Okay.
In other words, Fletcher, it's find that rhetorical device.
The first one, I think, is fairly easy, but I mean, that's not really very nice to Fletcher.
Yeah, don't say that.
As I fall flat on my face, yes.
But the first one technically comes from a Latin, actually. But anyway. Let's go. Kath, you want to start the first? We're going to read you various passages from famous literature and infamous literature, and we're going to see if you can guess what's going on and then guess the idea of the rhetorical device, okay?
Ooh, that's fun, yeah.
Ready?
Let's do it.
Okay, starting with Edgar Allan Poe. Doubting, dreaming dreams no mortal ever dared to dream before.
Ooh. Then we're going to move on to James Joyce. I should do a James Joyce accent, but I can't.
Please don't, Ross. For God's sake.
His soul swooned slowly as he heard the snow falling faintly through the universe and faintly falling like the descent of their last end upon all the living and the dead.
Yes.
And then now for Fletcher's sake, Kathy, we have
J.R. Tolkien, as I've always called him, from Lord of the Rings. Uh-huh. This is a lot of different things happening. Right through the press drove Theoden Thengol's son, and his spear was shivered as he threw down their chieftain. Out swept his sword, and he spurred to the standard, huge staff and bearer, and the black serpent foundered. Then all that was left unslain of their cavalry turned and fled far away.
Okay, and the last example, Fletcher, are going to be names. Just quickly, names that I'm sure you're very familiar with. Mickey Mouse, Peter Parker, Lois Lane, Marilyn Monroe, Luna Lovegood, and my favorite and yours, SpongeBob SquarePants. So what's going on here, Fletcher?
Well, this is, I believe, called alliteration.
Very good.
And so we are good. Repeating sounds over and over for effect, really.
Mm-hmm. Well, what you're doing, as you said, is you're repeating sounds. It's usually the initial consonant. So it's like Mickey Mouse, Peter Parker, P-P-L-L, et cetera, et cetera. And it's usually in neighboring words, two or more, or neighboring syllables. As a rhetorical device, it's less reading than hearing, obviously, this one. I mean, that's why you find it so often in poetry or in literature, because it has a lot of bang to it.
Mm-hmm. The interesting thing with this one, though, this is not Greek, though. This was first coined in the 1400s.
Oh.
But it's virtually in all languages. I mean, ranging from Arabic to Icelandic, Somali. And it's even used in American Sign Language as well. And the idea is basically it hones in an idea, and it's just beautiful. It's rhythmic. It's pleasant. It's nice to hear it. So we like it.
It's not always nice to hear. You know, Kathy, when you were reading some of those, I brought up you because I thought of the J.R.R. Tolkien passage. all those S's didn't really sound very nice to me.
Interesting.
It also... I wondered why that seemed like a very exciting passage, but the S's to me kind of deflated that a little bit.
Well, that's interesting, Fletcher. And as a matter of fact, that reminds me, we can give you an S, a killer S alliteration, which we used to know as a kid. She sells seashells by the seashore.
Well done,
now, that's
Ross.
The big black bug bled black blood. I used to love that as a kid. But those are both, in a way, very unpleasant alliterations because they're confusing, which is what you're saying Tolkien did, not deliberately, though. You're saying it, though, which is interesting.
Yeah, and the S sound kind of took away some of the power, I guess.
That's interesting because, yeah, S to me is not a strong sound,
right?
When you think about it. S is sort of slithery and... Like, what's that famous, it's another Edgar Allan Poe. You know the one I'm thinking of, Ross, because you always liked Poe back in the day, the something sibilant shivering of each some uncertain one. I can't remember it now, but it's very good.
But I have a question. Okay, because there's another S one here I just found. It was from Kennedy, JFK, and he had an S one. I'm just curious if Fletcher, you like this or not. Finally, whether you are citizens of America or citizens of the world, ask of us here the same high standards of strength and sacrifice which we ask of you. Now, I'm not sure that, and then citizens is sort of an S, is obviously an S sound too. Mm-hmm. So we have citizens, same standards, strength, and sacrifice. I'm going to repeat it again. Do you guys like this or not? This is the inaugural address where he uses alliteration a lot, and it's apparently a very famous speech. Finally, whether you are citizens of America or citizens of the world, ask of us here the same high standards of strength and sacrifice which we ask of you. I don't like it either, actually.
It sounds a little spitty, I think. You know what I mean?
It is.
I've got to be blunt here. I mean, no offense, but... No, I'm not crazy about the S's repeated, unless you're doing the slithering...
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I think like most things used in you know, I mean, carefully, it can be very beautiful, but it can sound sort of silly. Here's a Reagan address. We America stands safe today because brave men and women have been ready to face the fire at freedom's front.
You.
I don't like that.
No,
really.
Not at all.
Oh, I'm sorry. I found the Poe, and then we'll get off it. I think it's wonderful, though. The one I was thinking of is the silken, sad, uncertain rustling of each purple curtain. Silken, sad,
like
uncertain
that.
Rustling is perfect.
Yes, it is.
I think that's good.
Yeah, that's great. But that's not trying to evoke an idea of strength or power
or
anything,
right? It's just that the curtain's rustling. Yeah, I don't think S's work for... we got to talk to these people if they were still alive.
Well, I think we're going to have a problem with a lot of these people. Yeah.
I can try, Ross. I have abilities.
Okay, we're going to now move on, Fletcher, to another rhetorical device. And we're going to do... I'm going to do Yoda here, which I'm not going to do in an accent because Kathy will ridicule me. I think rightfully so. So I was going to do, I am wondering, why are you here?
Oh, that's great.
That's really good, Ross.
Thank you.
I'll be Luke, Ross. I'm looking for someone. I sound just like him.
Looking? Found someone you have. I would say,
Right.
Help you, I can. Yes.
I tell you, Ross, you've unleashed them. You've got that. This is a new thing.
From now on, whenever you have to do a British accent, Ross, just do Yoda. And
do Yoda. Yeah.
Apologies to all of our English British listeners and anyone else who appreciates that accent. But Ross never really got it all that well anyway.
No. Kathy, you want to do the next Yoda?
No, I'm not doing any Yoda. You're Mr. Yoda now.
Patience you must have, my young Padawan.
Okay, what, Fletcher, is the rhetorical device? You don't have to know the technical name, but just what is going on here?
He's shifting the syntax around. I mean, that's Yoda, right? That's what Yoda does. Mm-hmm. But that's all I really know about what's going on here.
That's what it is, though. Okay. Yoda is speaking with a classical rhetorical device called anastrophe.
Anastrophe.
Yes. Anastrophe.
Yes, it comes from the ancient Greek, and it's pronounced anastrophe in ancient Greek, incidentally, but I don't think we care. And it means a turning back or about. It's basically turning around. You're switching what you just said. You're switching the object, subject, and verb around. You're putting the, in this case, he puts the verb first. And we have that from my favorite, I've got to do this one. I loved the Rime of the Ancient Mariner when I was a kid for some reason. He holds him with his skinny hand. There was a ship, quoth he. Hold off, unhand me, Greybeard loon. Eftsoon his hand dropped he.
And old Coleridge, who did a lot of drugs, I want to say.
You're not just saying that because of the order in which he put his words, are you?
Who knows? I mean, let's be honest, right? But yeah, this is one I actually think works. I don't know about you guys. I like anastrophe. I mean, and not only when it's said in a yoga kind of voice. I mean, we had Robert Frost, Something There Is That Doesn't Love a Wall.
I always like that opening.
Yeah, me too.
And it immediately does what it's supposed to do. It focuses, actually, interestingly enough, in Greek and Latin, which are inflected languages, you can do that very easily because it doesn't really matter what the word order is in many cases. But right here, there is something there is that doesn't love a wall. I just really love that opening line. I always did.
But now I'm thinking out loud because I was going to say, usually you use anastrophe, you're emphasizing a concept or you're just making it rhyme better, you know, to be honest with you, which is, I think, the case of Coleridge sometimes, but that's beside the point. I don't think, we don't really do that in regular convo, though, do we?
Not very much. We do it in poetry. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, like Shakespeare did it with like neither a borrower nor a lender be, which I always think of the Gilligan's Island, but that's beside the point too. And to thine own self be true. Those are anastrophes. But I'm just trying to think of a case when I speak, do I do it for emphasis? Can you guys think of any? I can't.
No, Reagan, they have a speech with Reagan, which I would never, you're right, I'm just hearing it. It's a good open air. And how stands the city on this winter night? That's actually a beautiful line. But you're right, I would never use it in a sentence.
No, this to me is really rhetoric.
It is rhetoric or it's literary. Because I remember The Hobbit, and that's a really great opening line. In a hole in the ground, there lived a hobbit.
Mm.
That's a good line, not a nasty, dirty, wet hole. I always loved that, filled with the ends of
water. Yeah, because the other way,
smell.
A hobbit lived in a hole in the ground.
Right.
Doesn't sound boring. It's good. That would be the one I would have written.
Also, the whole paragraph is really about the hole in the ground. It's like the hobbit was a hobbit hole. And that's a whole big thing. And he opens it with the key, the subject of the sentence, in effect, even though it's an object.
Right. In a hole in the ground. And it kind of leads us into that hole, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. In an exciting, mysterious way, as opposed to a hobbit lived in a hole in the ground, which it amazes me, though, how the word order really changes it.
It really does.
It's dull the other way. I think Kathy's right, though. I can't see. Using it, I can't see me doing. But.
I think Ross, time it is to move on to the next.
This is Amanda Gorman during the inauguration poem.
Mm-hmm.
We will rise from the golden hills of the West. We will rise from the windswept northeast where our forefathers first realized revolution. We will rise from the lake-rimmed cities of the Midwestern states. We will rise from the sun-baked south.
Okay, I'm gonna do a number two so you can figure it out. We got Dickens here. I think you would have figured this one out. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief. It was the epoch. Is it epoch or epoch? Epoch, right?
I think so, yeah.
Of belief. It was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair.
And now we're going to throw in, I think, some Babylon 5 writing is copying Dickens a little bit here. Okay. It was the year of fire, the year of destruction, the year we took back what was ours. It was the year of rebirth, the year of great sadness, the year of pain, and the year of joy.
I don't get the Dickens, Ross. Sorry. Okay, Fletcher?
Right.
Find that rhetorical device.
It's at the beginning of each sentence. I don't know what this is called, but in each case, they're repeating the beginning couple words, the beginning phrase sort of each sentence. What was the Gorman?
We will rise.
Yeah, we will rise, we will rise, we will rise. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was. Yeah, so repeating that just kind of adds more weight each time to what the person is saying. It builds more and more each time they repeat that phrase.
Exactly. It's called anaphora, A-N-A-P-H-O-R-A, anaphora. And it's exactly what you said. It's the words are repeating at the beginning of the successive, whether the clauses or sentences or phrases. And that's where, as you said, it builds. And these are actually really stirring examples, I think.
It comes from an ancient Greek word meaning anaphorein, to means to carry up back or to bring up, which is what it's doing. You keep redoing it. And I think there was an example here we had which really shows the power of it. Take a normal sentence. I worked out, I exercised, and I ate a sandwich. And that's dull. But if we change it with a little bit more of an aphora, we can do, I worked out despite nagging fatigue. I worked out despite paralyzing self-doubt. And I worked out despite overpowering reluctance. But that sort of, I mean, it can, if done right, it can carry a lot of power. Mm-hmm. Done poorly, it can be really dull.
So. Now, again with this one, I've certainly written, I know, anaphoric, would it be, things when I'm trying to sound like, you know, really fancy. But now in convo, do you really think, I mean, okay, Winston Churchill, we shall fight, we shall fight, we shall fight, I'm thinking. But are there ones that we do in conversation?
Kathy, I'm tired of your making excuses and calling them jokes when you made a mistake. Kathy, I'm tired of you. I actually think we do sometimes,
yeah.
Really.
I think when you're right.
You know, I was just kidding. I mean, seriously, obviously.
Thank you.
But I think we do use it. I really do.
Yeah, actually, I'm thinking you're. Okay, here's one. Go big or go home. Let's go, go. Yeah. Okay.
A little.
So now, Fletcher, we're going to reverse this time. So we just did. We're going to do a cousin of what we just learned, and it's called epistrophe. Can you guess what epistrophe is? Let's see. Kathy, why don't you read something and we'll see if Fletcher can guess.
I have something at the tip of my brain right now. Oh, here's an example from Tolkien again. Okay.
This is the movie, though.
Okay, so it's not really Tolkien. This is Aragorn in The Return of the King. Mm-hmm. A day may come when the courage of men fails, when we forsake our friends and break all bonds of fellowship. But it is not this day, an hour of woes and shattered shields when the age of men comes crashing down. But it is not this day. This day we fight.
And then in another example from, I really thought this was beautiful, Robert Penn Warren, who no one really seems to read anymore. But he goes, the big sycamore by the creek was gone. The willow tangle was gone. The little enclave of untrodden bluegrass was gone. The clump of dogwood and the little rise above the creek, now that too was gone.
Yeah, that's nice. And so in this case, we're sticking that repeated phrase or the repeated words at the end of the sentences.
Well done, mm-hmm. Fletcher.
So the first one was an anaphora and the second one was epistrophe.
Right. Not apostrophe. Apostrophe.
Right.
Now I'm going to keep thinking apostrophe.
I know.
Yeah, and that's really nice there with the Robert Penn Warren because it you really do get that feeling that something has left, something is gone.
Yeah.
Each time, and it does, it just builds and it adds to that melancholy.
Yeah, it really does. I thought it was a beautiful series there, a paragraph. It's from Flood, A Romance of Our Time, incidentally. Okay, Kath, do you want to do, which one do you want to do?
What about Litotes?
Okay.
Is that a good one? Because that's something that you always do.
That sounds a little bit like a skin disease or something.
We were going to ask you to guess it, but we already said it. It was Litotes. Yeah, it does. I don't like the sound of this word either, but we're going to do. But in 2015... The Guardian newspaper declared that litotes was the most common rhetorical advice that you've never heard of.
Wow.
But now we've all heard of litotes. Everyone has right now. So the question now is, Fletcher, tell us what the most common rhetorical device we've never heard of called litotes. Give us an example.
Oh,
now.
Boy.
Ross, let's be fair. Okay, I'm going to ask you something, Ross. How do you think he's doing? Huh?
Not bad, Kathy.
Okay.
Okay, let's give you an example, Fletcher. You're a film person. This is a film a while back, Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Are you aware, Mrs. Bueller, that Ferris does not have what we consider to be an exemplary attendance record?
Oh, so is this the what everyone refers to as the rhetorical question?
No.
Oh.
It's a little bit, it could be snarky, but it doesn't have to be snarky. Okay. Kathy, you want to give another example?
You know, she's not as young as she used to be.
Fletcher, you're no spring chicken. What is this, like, insult Fletcher?
You know, this
wasn't
half bad, this one, Ross.
I don't see the common thread.
Okay, this is a devised figure of speech, too. And it's what we're trying to do is we're not saying something outright. We're basically kind of understating what we're trying to say. Mm. In other words, like, Fletcher, you're not really a bad guy. No, we're saying we think you're a great guy, but we're understating how great you are.
Right.
Say you're not a bad guy.
Right.
And I mean, often it's double negatives. Like you say something's not bad instead of good.
Right. If you remember, we opened with that. How's Fletcher doing? He's not doing that bad.
Okay. Yeah, that sort of, all right. I was paying attention to too many things, I think, when I was trying to figure that out.
Mm-hmm.
She's not as young as she used to be. She's old now. You're no spring chicken. You're old now.
Or let's say if you kept blowing all of these things, you know, I might go, well, Fletcher's not the sharpest tool in the shed, Kathy.
You sound like you're coming from, like, you know, like a Ma and Pa kettle. Yeah, not the sharpest tool in the shed.
That example is like probably sort of like 1910 or something.
But the thing is sometimes you're actually doing it to be nice. I mean, mm-hmm. not the sharpest tool in the shed is a lot nicer than saying, gosh, he's like stupid, you know?
Yeah.
So sometimes you are it can be used to soften things.
Uh-huh.
Other times it can be a positive, like not half bad. Like, gee, it's mm-hmm. better than I expected.
Right.
Not half mm-hmm. bad, not
right.
bad.
Right.
How was the lasagna? Not bad.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I guess we use that basically all the time. You know, I ask somebody how they're doing. They say, yeah, not too bad.
Yeah. It comes from the word that means simple, which is interesting to me. Because I'm thinking, like, why simple in this case?
I don't know. I mean, it does mean, you know, you're right. I mean, it does come from simplicity. Litos is smooth, plain, and then style, like a simple style. I don't know.
Yeah, because it's just an interesting, it just seems to be an interesting construct in that way. Because I wouldn't have thought of this, I would have thought as, like, you know, understating, perhaps, something that meaning that. But simple wouldn't have been the first thing I would have thought of.
But it is understated, but I'm just wondering why.
It's no, a, I I'm guess saying, but I'm saying the word itself. I'm talking about the word itself,
I don't know.
The etymology.
Perhaps if you had studied more at Wagner College, you would know.
That wasn't the nicest thing, Ross.
You're Saying It Wrong is part of the NPR network and is produced in the studios of KMUW in Wichita, Kansas by me, Fletcher Powell. Kathy Petrus records from her home in Armilla, Spain. Ross Petrus from his home in Toronto, Ontario in Canada. Torrin Anderson composed our theme music, and our digital team is Beth Golay, Kate Hutchins, and Carly Cooper. If you have a question for Kathy and Ross, you can email me at powell@kmuw.org or email them at kandrpetrus@gmail.com. You can find all of their books pretty much anywhere you get books, and a handful of them are also available on audiobook, read by the authors themselves. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.